This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Comedy can almost be charted as a series of episodes. Vaudeville, movies, the Catskills, the variety shows and sitcoms that migrated from radio to television, improv, sketches, stand-up. Our guest this hour was along for a lot of that ride and in the driver's seat for some of it. Carl Reiner played in a GI review during the Second World War, went into theater and on radio before going to TV, first as a writer and performer on Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows, then as creator, writer, and producer of the show that set the bar for the TV sitcom, The Dick Van Dyke Show. Then movies, four pictures with Steve Martin, Oh God with George Burns, Where's Papa with George Segal, and half a dozen more, and that's not even to mention the novels, the memoirs, the readings, and of course, The 2,000-Year-Old Man. And Carl Reiner is still working, most recently in the big heist picture Ocean's 11, where thief Brad Pitt meets Reiner's character Saul Bloom at a dog track to talk him into coming out of retirement for one last job.
So you're going to tell me, or should I just say no and get it over with?
Saul, you're the best there is. You're in Cooperstown. What do you want?
Nothing. I got a duplex now. I got wall to wall and a goldfish. I'm seeing a nice lady who works the unmentionable counter at Macy's. I've changed.
He hasn't changed. If you have questions for Carl Reiner, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Carl Reiner joins us now from the Museum of Radio and Television in Beverly Hills, California. And it's great to talk with you again.
Oh, I loved hearing. Thank you. It's great to talk to you. I loved hearing that thing from Ocean's 11. What a clever thing to do, to introduce a guy with a little snippet that I never knew existed as a snippet.
Well, snippets are eminently snippable.
Snippets are you.
Well, you just apparently one more job, one last job for Saul Bloom wasn't enough. You just finished work on Ocean's 12.
Yes, and again, I was a reluctant member of the company. I declined at the beginning. I came in, and it's a most interesting picture. By the way, I think it's a two or three or four cuts above the last one, if you believe me. And it is.
And why should we believe you? You're in it.
Yes, no. I've never had more fun. I was in Rome, Chicago. We did some of it out here. And the best thing about it is playing with otters. Brad Pitt, George Clooney, Matt Damon, Casey Affleck, Don Cheadle, Scott Kahn, they play all day long. And as a matter of fact, the last day in Rome, I saw them doing things. They are really funny, but they're like little kids. And I said, after this picture is over, are you going to have to make play dates? Because they really are like kids.
You're old enough to remember pictures like this when they got the big heist. Hollywood would never let the guys get away with it. They always had to be caught.
I know, and that wasn't true to life, because most, you know, they're doing things called dead files or cold cases or things like that, because there are more cold cases or things that were not solved, crimes that were not solved than were solved. And yes, when the bars came down, and a lot of bars came down for all kinds of things, but the thieves getting away with it is wonderful, because now when you go to a movie, you don't know what the ending is. Before, you knew that the bad guys are going to get it and the good guys are going to prevail. Now you're not sure. And in this particular movie, by the way, which is really wonderful, because they're scamming the scammers. Everybody's scamming everybody else, and you don't know where you're at until the end, and then you won't know where you're at.
Well,
but you'll be entertained.
In the first picture, we all rooted for them to get away with Andy Garcia. He was such a terrible man in that movie.
Well, he comes back in this picture. He's chasing us now. It's wonderful. He wants his money back, and he gets to us. He finds us. He gets those goons of his to find us and put us in a position where we have to give him the money back, or something terrible will happen.
What did you think was going to happen when you, I guess, started out at the WPA's dramatic workshop in New York when you were a kid? Did you ever envision yourself as a distinguished character actor at the age of 80-plus?
No, I was a machinist helper working in a little machine shop, Mr. Wiglinski. I helped him fix sewing machines, little hat machines for ladies' hats. And my brother actually was the one who saw a little ad in the paper for free dramatic lessons at Central Theater, the 100th Center Street. It was just a government building.
That's where the courthouse is today, yeah.
Exactly. That's the little building I went in every day, and every day for 1 year. But it was the WPA project. If it wasn't for Franklin Roosevelt and my brother, I wouldn't be here today. But I didn't know was going to be an actor. He thought I had something in me. I could always make my friends laugh. But listen, now this is interesting. You mentioned WPA, and that is like, I'm 82 now, and I was 16 at the time, 17. And what I learned in that class, Mrs. Whitmore, an old, beautifully gray-haired English actress who was now teaching, she must have been 100 years old, but she says, you know, she says, we always have everybody learn from Shakespeare, you know, Hamlet or the To Be or Not to Be or the soliloquies. We're all going to learn Queen Gertrude's speech from Hamlet. So boys and girls will all learn Queen Gertrude's speech. Now, I learned that speech, and to this day, I haven't said it in maybe 30 years, maybe 40. There is a willow grows a slender brook that shows his hoar leaves in the glassy stream. There with fantastic garlands did she come, with crowflowers, nettles, daisies, and long purples that liberal shepherds give a grosser name, but our cold maids do dead men's fingers call them. Anyway, I could go on, but I realize this is only a half-hour show. But isn't that amazing that to this day I remember that, and I think it stood me in good stead, because for interviews like this, I can conjure it up and waste a little time.
and you're going to need more, because it's an hour show. Anyway.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Then I go. I'm going to finish it for you.
Okay, no. Go ahead. Oh, well.
No.
Well, it was another Shakespearean speech, though, where you came up, I guess, performed Double Talk for the first time.
Well, that was one of the most embarrassing moments of my life, and it turned out to be something that I used for the rest of my life for comedy. I was in the Avon Shakespearean Touring Company, and we had four plays, As You Like It, Taming of the Shrew, Comedy of Errors, and Hamlet. And we learned the first two plays in Atlanta, Georgia, and then went on tour, and we're going to learn the rest of them. We're going to learn Hamlet. We weren't going to do Hamlet for about 3-4 weeks, and I would be learning my part of King Claudius. When we came to Opelika, Georgia, I think it was Opelika, Georgia, got a telegram saying, we don't want Taming of the Shrew. We had it last year. We want Hamlet this year. And everybody in the company knew Hamlet. They had played it. And I was a neophyte. I had not learned my King Claudius speech lines. And with 3 days of rehearsal, some of the lines were laying very lightly on my head. I stayed up all night studying, walked around the quadrangle, went from light to light in the middle of the night, trying to read my book and study it. And I came upon the fourth act, where Claudius, and I'll do it for you, I'll recreate this horrible moment, where the speech was, Claudius is speaking to the Queen Gertrude, and he says, oh, Gertrude, Gertrude, when sorrows come, they come not single spies, but in battalions. Now, I had a half a page after that I could not remember. I tipped my head to the side, and all the words fell out of my ear. You know, it was lying lightly on my brain. And so I didn't know what to do. Laertes was in my friend Gene Lyons, a wonderful actor who became very important in Broadway Theater years later. But he was in the wings waiting to hear for his cue. He wouldn't come out until he heard his cue. And I couldn't get to it. So I said, oh, Gertrude, Gertrude, when sorrows come, they come not single spies, but in battalions. The people muddied in their thoughts for poor Polonius's death doth have the very calls of Hamitol that takes the default, that I, with the pawns of fate, that kind upon the fall, say and I, nostril, thou unions break, thou grotus with frown, thou dost to the falling break the sound, thou canst not in the very calls of Hamitol, and I'm waving him on, and he's not coming, thou stands and fall to the very call. He finally comes on, and I'll tell you, I got the biggest applause that night that I've ever gotten. They saw somebody with passion, and they didn't know what, it was in the South, so they didn't really know what I was saying. And you know something, I got major applause, but the following couple of nights later, I really learned the speech. And when I did it exactly as Shakespeare wrote it, I got nothing. I got a bigger hand for my version of Claudius' speech in the fourth act.
Well, what do you expect from a guy who can't get it all done in three acts anyway?
I know. That's funny.
Couldn't have been easy to ad lib in iambic pentameter, though.
I didn't know I could do that until that moment, and I was so upset with myself until I got into a luncheonette the next day. Gene Lyons was the guy. He was still laughing about it, and he said to somebody who hadn't been there, some people at the, he said, "You should see what this guy did last night." I said, "Please, please." And he says, "Do it, do it." And he made me do it again. And now they laughed, and I realized I had a tool that I would use later on in life in the show of shows. My gosh, we did not only, I never did Shakespeare there, but we did Italian double talk, German, we did foreign movies, and the fact that I could double talk made me a career.
We're talking with Carl Reiner. Of course, you're invited to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN at NPR.org. Let's begin with Joe, who's with us from Fairfield, Iowa.
Mr. Reiner, thanks
yes, sir.
For being such a comic genius. You've brought so much joy into the lives of everybody in this country and people throughout
let's
the world.
Let's see if I can bring you one more moment of joy. What can I do for you?
I wanted to ask what it was like to be at the Hillcrest Country Club in L.A., where you could regularly sit around with so many of America's comic geniuses.
Aha! Now you got a subject that I really know nothing about. I never sat around in Hillcrest. I didn't have the kind of money to join Hillcrest that George Burns and his friends had. I was there as a visitor maybe once or twice, but you've got the wrong guy. You'll have to ask that question to George Burns, but he's gone.
If you can he's get him gone, on, we'll lead with that interview.
No, I never was a member of Hillcrest, but I like you, wondered what went on there because they were all very rich. I think when there was like hundreds of thousands of dollars to join that club, and I didn't play golf, so there was no reason to get the money together to do it.
Well, I hate to disabuse you, Joe, but that's the fact.
That's okay. Thanks for Bert Rigby, You're a Fool. It might have been a...
Oh, wait a second. Great. Stay there. Stay there a second. Now you hit one of the best things that I did in my life, and nobody ever saw it or heard from it.
I've seen it 10 times. I think the scene where Bert is doing that rendition from that Gene Kelly movie.
Oh, yes. Yes.
It is the most brilliant... funny, fabulous song and dance scene.
I should say for those who aren't students of the Carl Reiner historiography, this is Bert Rigby, You're a Fool, which you also wrote.
Yes. You know, that's very... This has never happened to me before. I went to see a play in New York called For Me and My Girl. It starred Robert Lindsay. I was taken with this guy. He won the Tony Award that year. He won the Caesar Award the year before in London doing the same. I did something I have never done before, but I've seen it done in movies where a producer walks backstage and says, "You're very good." I was put my producer hat on. I said, "You know something?" I said to the guy, "You're great. You're brilliant." He says, "Thank you, thank you." And he sort of didn't know me. He asked somebody, "Who is this guy?" Or that's right. They said, "Carl Reiner is coming back to see you." And he found out who I was. He didn't know about the Dick Van Dyke Show or Show of Shows. And when I came back, I said, "Would you be interested in doing, have you ever done a movie?" He said, "Not really. No, he hadn't done any major movies." I said, "Would you like to star in a movie if I can come up with one?" I swear I said that to him. I don't know what I had in my head, but I said something could be written for this guy. And 2 days later, I came up with the idea of a coal miner who loved Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly and used to dance in the coal mines and sing in the coal mines for his friends. And his dream is to be a performer. Never would happen. And I said, "Well, how could we make that happen?" And I came, we had a little lunch, and I said, "Robert," I said, "I've got this idea. You want to go with it? And he says, "Certainly." I wrote it. I brought it to the studio with Lorimar at the time, Bernie Brillstein. They bought it. We made the movie, went to London. And what happened is Lorimar went out of business and Warner Brothers took over. And the film fell between the cracks. But as you can see, there's a man in Ohio who saw it.
And he did. We'll hear more from Carl Reiner after a short break. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest is Carl Reiner, a writer and director of Bert Rigby, You're a Fool, and a few other things in show business. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And let's hear from Susan, who's with us from Newark, New Jersey.
Hi. This is I'm actually on the shoulder of the New Jersey Turnpike, but I had to call Mr. Ryan because my father was in the service. I don't know if he worked directly with him, but I remember him telling stories about doing some musicals and skits, and it has shaped my sense of humor. It's as I said to the woman who took my call, you made me the warped woman that I am today.
Oh, I'm so we need more warped people. The trouble is too many people are straight-laced. We need warped. Now, where was your father? What was his name? And let's find out.
His name was Jim Plunkett, James Clarence Plunkett, and he was from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And he wrote lots of show tunes on his own. He ended up being in the being a code breaker in India, but when he was stateside, he had done a few things. So I don't know, maybe he weaved a tale, or somehow he just kept talking about Carl Reiner and some of the theater things that he had done in the service.
Oh, gosh. Plunkett. Yeah, I remember a quarterback named Plunkett. I don't know, but we probably did know each other, because if he knew, nobody ever claimed they knew me. There was no reason to do that, no reason on God's earth. But so he probably did know me, but send me a picture of him. I want to see Plunkett.
He's a marvelous man, and what you have done, you know, there's so many people who think that you have to be somber in order to be serious.
And No, that's not true. As a matter of fact, if you're too somber, you never can get serious. You're somber. There's a difference between somber and serious.
Now, according to our bio information, you perform with Maurice Evans Special Services Entertainment Unit in something called G.I. Hamlet?
No, G.I. Hamlet was one of the many shows that we did that was produced in Hawaii under his auspices. And by the way, he was my major, and Alan Ludden of Password was my captain. And I was on my way to Iwo Jima, and I was traded out of my outfit to get to be part of this entertainment section, because I was an entertainer at the time, but I was in the Signal Corps. They took me out of the Signal Corps, and I did work there. And G.I. Hamlet was one of the programs done, and I did a show called Shape Ahoy, which I wrote with a couple of friends, and we performed all over the South, the Pacific, the Central and South.
Mm-hmm. Iwo Jima was a tough house, so just as well not to go.
You know something? That's one of I wrote a book called My Anecdotal Life, and in it I talk a little about. No. As a matter of fact, I made it part of a book called Continue Laughing, a fictionalized version of the true story. I was on my way to Iwo Jima the day I was going to Iwo Jima. Oh, here we are. We're going full circle. I went to see G.I. Hamlet, and my friend Howie Morris, who I'd been in radio with in early. Late 30s, he was playing Laertes. I went backstage to tell him how good he was, and he said, hey, without even taking a beat, he said, hey, have you got an act? And I said, yes, I do, because he knew I was a funny guy. And I said, I do. He said, how many got? I said, 25 minutes. You want to audition for Maurice Evans? A comedian fell out of another show. And I said, I can't. I'm going someplace tomorrow. He's where? I said, I don't know. He said, audition. So I auditioned, and I did my double talk of Maurice Evans, who used to spit a lot. I did a double talk version of him doing Hamlet, and I spit. And he laughed, and he said, we want you. And I said, I'm going someplace. And he called a General Richardson, and they traded me like a ball player. He got me, and I went. Now, this is the interesting thing. My friends all went on to Iwo Jima. They all lived, thank goodness. But it was a year later, on VJ Day, I'm doing this show called Shape Ahoy. We played all over the Pacific. We land in Iwo Jima. There's 17 installations to play. I look at the top, and I said, it's VJ Day today, and I'm playing the 3117 Signal Battalion, my old group. Hadn't seen them in a year. And there I am, the star of a show with my guys out front. It was like a bad Dan Daly movie. It was one of the most memorable things. So memorable that I'm telling you about it today, 50 years later.
Susan, thanks for the call. And, well, she's the warped lady who was calling us from the New Jersey Turnpike. Speaking of warped people, one of Carl Reiner's enduring roles is as the ever-patient interviewer with the 2,000-year-old man of sketch he's reprised through the years with Mel Brooks. In this bit, Brooks talks about comedy 2,000 years ago when being devoured by a tiger was all it took to get a laugh.
And did we get hysterical? We were laughing.
Well,
that was the best joke we ever had.
Well, sir, that's not very funny.
What did we have? RKOs then? That's all we had.
Yeah, but I mean, I would consider that.
That was the best we had. Murray took a tiger.
That was entertainment.
Yes.
But I would consider that in the realm of tragedy rather than comedy. How do you differentiate between tragedy?
It's your point of view. To me, tragedy, if it is, if I'll cut my finger. That's tragedy. It bleeds and I'll cry and I'll run around and I'll go into Mount Sinai for a day and a half. I'm very nervous about it. And to me, comedy is if you walk into an open sewer and die. What do I care? That's comedy.
I see. That's your definition.
My fingers.
I still laugh at that man.
He's still pretty funny.
Oh, he is. I just had dinner with him the other night. He still does that to me. He makes me laugh every time I see him.
Does he, you're the interviewer, you're the straight guy here. Has he ever answered the same question the same way twice?
No, that was one of the problems. We did the 2,000-year-old man for 10 years before we recorded it. And he never could remember. You know, the only time we ever learned it, when we had to go on the Ed Sullivan Show after 1950 to 1960, we did it at parties and dinner parties and friends' houses. In 1960, Steve Allen heard it, and he says, you've got to put this on record, fellas, or somebody's going to steal it. As a matter of fact, George Burns is the one that said, put it on record or I'll steal it. And so we did, and that's how it – what was the question?
Did he ever answer the same question
way
twice?
Yes.
I was saying
that the only time we ever learned anything was learned 7 minutes to go on the Sullivan Show, because if you ad lib, you might come up with nothing. So we said, we've got 7 minutes. We learned a part of the record. I asked him many times who his favorite wife was of his 1,200 wives. He always gave me a different name and a different reason for thinking she was the best.
Well, let's take a call with Jason, who's calling from Sacramento, California.
Yes, hi. I'm a comedic actor up here in Sacramento, and I've been, in my opinion, fortunate enough to work with a lot of funny, funny geniuses here. However, you are above and beyond one of all of the comedians I've ever worked with.
I got you fooled.
I was lucky enough to be in Laughter on the 23rd Floor, which is based on your show of shows. I was just hoping to hear a little bit of the insight about working on that and Mel and everybody in that environment.
Well, if you were on Laughter on the 23rd Floor that Neil Simon wrote, and it was a pretty accurate portrayal of what went on in the writer's room of the show of shows on Caesar's Hour, what it was a bunch of comedians with different kinds of comedy ability, and everyone fighting for their joke to get on the air so they can say to their wives, I wrote that joke, honey, because there was that kind of competition. But when something was really funny, everyone really knew it, and they piled in and said, okay, let it be in. But they fought like cats and dogs to get their material into the show. I remember Mel Brooks used to come in late very often. He was an insomniac, and he couldn't get up early, and he'd come late, and he'd always challenge everybody. All right, what are your geniuses, right? We'd yell at him. We decided to teach him a lesson because he came like we started at 10, he would come at 12, 1:30, and he would always send us coffee up before him. He'd order coffee that come from some store. And I remember giving a guy a $20 tip for 30, 65 cents worth of coffee and donut. And he got so furious, but he still came late. But I remember him saying once, where's the genius? Let's hear the genius you guys wrote. And they said, you come up with something. You come up with something. So he came up with this. The man ate so many carrots that, and we said, what? You're going to write a joke about carrots, eating carrots and seeing? I mean, what are you? And he was pinned to a wall. He says, it's going to be the greatest joke ever. It's going to be. And he said, while he's pinned to the wall, he says, the man ate so many carrots that he couldn't sleep. And he says, why? Because he could see through his eyelids. He made a joke where we knew there was no joke to be made, and we never forgot that Mel had that ability. He'd squeeze into a wall. I always said a comic mind, a genius comic mind pressed to the point of panic will come up with something you cannot believe.
Here's an email that goes along with Jason's phone call from Ron in Chester, Pennsylvania. Is there going to be another CD of the 2,000-year-old man, or is Mel too busy with the producers on Broadway in the future movie? And by the way, does Mel have a cameo lined up for you in the movie?
I don't think he has a cameo, because that movie is that movie's on track. Everything that's in that movie in the play will be seen in the movie. No, he does. Will there be another 2,000-year-old man? If I have anything to do about it, and we live long enough, and we lived it till the 2000, and he's now 2,000, and actually 19, he's 2,024, I think, or something like that. It was 1960. You do it. Yeah, 2,024. when he finishes with those things, I must say that I have, the world is so crazy and so chaotic that I want to hear him talk about the possibilities of this next generation and what's going to happen to us. So I do think if I get him alone in a room someplace, and he's a hard sell, he always says, no, he never wants to do anything until he does it, and then he's so excited that he does it better than anybody.
Well, the emails are already coming, 2,044, to get the math right. It's depressing to come up with the right number, I know. You talked about laughter. Jason, by the way, thanks for the phone call. You talked about laughter on the 23rd floor. You wrote, in a way, about that writing team in the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Well, the Dick Van Dyke Show came to life because I was, when the review format disappeared, which is the Show of Shows and Caesar's Hour, there were no, I did one review after that, the Dinah Shore Show. I wrote on the Dinah Shore Show, but I was being offered a lot of situation comedies, and my wife and I read them, and we said, it's not good enough. And she said, why don't you write one? I said, I don't know how to write a situation comedy. And this is true. I say to people very often, talk to yourself more often, because if you're fairly intelligent, you may hear a fairly good answer to something you've asked. And I really said this out loud on 96th Street and the East River Drive, the FDR Drive in New York. I was thinking about what could I write about. And I said, what piece of ground do I stand on that nobody else stands on? I said, well, because no two people stand on the same ground, even twins. They're in a crib together. One's looking out the window. One's looking at the picture of the teddy bear on the wall. And so everybody has different experiences. And I said, well, I live in New Rochelle. I have two children. I have a wife. I work in New York doing a variety show. I says, well, why don't you write about that? That was my answer. And I went home, and I think in 4 days I had what was called head of the family at the time. And I wrote it for myself. And when we did a pilot, and I'd written 13 episodes because I knew if I was the star of the show, I would have to have a Bible for other writers that came in. So I wrote a second show and then a third. And by 7 weeks, I had 13 episodes, and I did my best shot, and it didn't sell. And was I disappointed? I was so upset. I said, well, it's my best shot. And I started writing movies at the time. I wrote Thrill of It All for James Garner and Doris Day, and I had another movie, Cooking All... I'll tell you later. And so I was really very disappointed. I would never want to do television again. And my agent had another client called Sheldon Leonard. He called me and said, you can't let these 13 scripts. I said, I don't want to fail with the same material twice. And he said, no, we'll get a better actor to play you. He had that kind of a New York East voice.
He always played tough guys. He was a gangster in the old movies.
Yeah, he was. He always played touts. In radio, he played a lot of touts. Been on 17. He's a winner. And anyway, he convinced me that there, and he told me about Dick Van Dyke in New York, and I know Dick, and I went to see him by Bert. He said, perfect, he's perfect. And he turned out not only to be better than me, but so much better than me, that if he hadn't done the part and we hadn't gotten Mary Tyler Moore and Dick and Rosemary and Maury, we wouldn't be talking about that show today. But that was the genesis of that show. Talk to yourself, folks. Ask yourself a question.
And after you get out of Bellevue, tell them you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Carl Reiner, you ended up writing 39 episodes of the Dick Van Dyke Show, as well as appearing in many of them in the role of Alan Brady.
Listen, you guys, you know these advertising guys are very sensitive and they have to be romance, so I'll do all the talking.
Yeah, and I'll do all the romance.
If I need any help, I'll ask for it.
Yes, if Alan needs any help.
Shut up, Mel.
Yes, sir.
Okay, fellas, we'll grab a quick bite and then get over there.
I couldn't eat a thing.
I'm treating.
I'm starving.
Hello? Shut up, Mel.
here's an email from Karen Funk Blocker in Tucson, Arizona. My husband and I have been enjoying the Dick Van Dyke Show DVD sets. Watching 5 seasons of episodes in order helps to give us a sense of how it developed over the years. One game I've been playing while watching the DVDs is Carl Reiner spotting, which specifically Alan Brady spotting. Why was Rob's boss kept mostly off camera for so much of the show's run?
Oh, very good question. When I decided to play the role of Alan Brady, I said to myself, I wanted Alan Braid to be a big television star. And I said, well, I was a second banana on television to Sid Caesar. I said, if I play the role, and I wasn't going to get a major player to play it because it was going to be a small part. It was the offstage threat of being fired. And I said, if I show my face, they'll say, that's Carl Reiner from Show a Show. He's not such a big star. So I decided not to show this guy. Alan Braid would be like a mystery. You see the back of his head. You'd see him on a phone or under a towel at a barbershop. And I realized that. And I, by the way, I couldn't be in many of the shows because I was writing, and the ones I wasn't writing, I was this. In those days, I was the producer and the story editor and the major writer. I had written the first 40 out of the first 60 shows myself, and so I had no time to get on the stage and act. So I didn't write them in, or didn't care to write them in. But after we got a couple of ideas that required some good acting by this part, I said, it's unfair to the viewers to hear him as a radio personality. Let's see his face. And so we turned him around. And when I got Persky and Denhoff, the two writers who became the story editors in the fourth year, and they wrote some wonderful shows. They wrote the best show that Alan Braid ever had, with Mary telling the world that he wore a toupee, Coast to Coast Big Mouth. We had to turn him around to see his reaction to the input that other people were giving him.
Well, in a way, you were playing Sid Caesar.
Well, everybody thought I was playing Sid Caesar. I was playing the star of a show, but Alan Braid is a terrible man. Sid is a lovely man. But I was playing a combination of three people, fictional and real. The real people were Milton Berle, who was a tremendous, had effect on television that nobody else in the world has ever had. He made television.
Mr. Television.
But he was also a terrible boss. He yelled at people. He said he'd ask for impossible things. He was screaming. Off stage, he was the single nicest person in the world. He gave to everybody. He was a charitable person quietly. And then there was a guy named Jackie Gleason, who was a bigger-than-life character who had a show and never talked to his writers. He used to have the writers slip the material in his under the door of his hotel room, and he never rehearsed. And then there was a show with Phil Silvers called Top Banana about Milton Berle, really. So that amalgam of a crazy leader of a show, the boss and star of a show, that was the amalgam I made. It wasn't Sid. Sid was a pussycat. I was with Sid for 9 years, and we had lunch every day, so it couldn't have been Sid, but everybody thought I was doing Sid.
Did he treat?
Yeah, we did. He was a big treater. By the way, Alan Braid is not dead. He's there's a show called The Father of the Pride, and I was invited to come to play. And this is a new show coming in on NBC at the end of the
month. Animated show, yeah.
Yeah, an animated show. And when they called me to play the part of the Father of the Pride, the other lions, it's all about the white lions and... I hear music in the background.
We're going to have to finish this story after we come back from a break.
Oh, that people will tune in to hear the rest of this story.
It's a cliffhanger with Carl Reiner. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. And in our last exciting episode, author, writer, director, and actor Carl Reiner was telling us about his new role as the Father of the Pride.
Yes, it's about white lions that live with Siegfried and Roy in their compound in Las Vegas. And these white lions, I think John Goodman plays the husband, Cheryl Hines plays his wife, and I play her father, the father-in-law of John Goodman, and I hate him because I'm an African lion. And I have pride. And he was born in Vegas. So I have no... my daughter married way beneath her, and I'm very upset with this. But the interesting thing is, when they asked me, Jeff Katzenberg at DreamWorks called me and said, would you like to play this part? And I read it. It was very funny. And then when I read further the description, I said, I know why they came to me. Because what happened is that this lion was called Sarmoti. That's his name. Siegfried and Roy... Masters of the Impossible, Sarmoti. He's the lead lion in their show, and he's now getting aged. He's of an age where his haunches no longer can propel him into the big leaps. And so when he has to leap through a fiery hoop at the end of the show, he hits his head on the... he doesn't leap high enough, and he hits his head on the loop and knocks off his toupee. He doesn't have a mane. He has a toupee.
You still do toupee jokes.
Yeah, and I realized that's why they thought of me. They wanted Alan Brady. He's a mean, terrible guy who's awful to everybody. He's a total hedonist. He cares only about his own comfort. And it's a terribly funny show. But Alan Brady is still alive in Sarmoti.
Well, when somebody came up with this script, didn't somebody say, you know, something just terrible happened to Siegfried and Roy and their big cats the other day. Maybe we might want to reconsider here.
Well, what happened is we had already recorded two or three shows when Roy had that unfortunate accident with his... And we immediately, Katzenberg called, you know, Siegfried and said, what do we do? We're going to stop. And Siegfried was saying, no, we must continue, because he said this is important to Roy. And they didn't even know he would recover. But Roy is fine now, and it's really important to them, because they're not going to be able to perform their show maybe ever again. But Siegfried and Roy's name are now going to be in front of the public as animated figures. And by the way, I must say, to their credit, the two guys who play Siegfried and Roy are two brilliant actors who are so funny, and it's so well written. But it really wrecks these two guys. It takes them, and they're making real fun of these guys, and they love it. They said, oh, the more the better, the more the better. They don't mind being ridiculed.
In addition to his own performances, Carl Reiner has frequently donned the hat of movie director. He was behind the cameras for Steve Martin's screen debut, the 1979 film The Jerk. In the movie, Martin plays the adopted son of a poor black sharecropper who leaves home to make a name for himself and realizes his most modest ambition.
Well, I wish I could get that excited about Buck.
Nothing! Are you kidding? Page 73, Johnson, Maven, R. I'm somebody now! Millions of people look at this book every day! This is the kind of spontaneous publicity, your name in print, that makes people! I'm in print! Things are going to start happening to me now.
And antics ensue, yes.
Oh, I'm laughing. That is so funny. A guy, you know, that is funny. Guys, you know, I flash back to remembering my high school when I graduated high school. It's the first time I saw my name in print, graduating with 1,500 other people, and there was my name on the R. I made it. I'm in print. I shouldn't laugh at our own stuff.
Ed joins us on the line from Lenoir, North Carolina.
Yeah. I was getting ready to quote that exact same phrase that you played, because every year when the new phone book comes, I jump around my office or my work and say, the new phone book's here, the new phone book's here. And my friends who have seen the movie, who I explained the movie to, just thinks it's hysterical. But then I showed the movie to my wife, and she thought it was the most politically incorrect thing she had ever seen. She was so repulsed by that. And I was wondering if you ever had that problem where people see your comedy and are just repulsed by, or just take offense to it.
I guess there is nothing ever done that is worthwhile that somebody does not take offense to. If they don't take offense to it, you probably haven't done anything. You've dropped a stone in the water and there are no ripples. That means you've dropped a feather into the water. You must make ripples or you're not making art. But I think your wife is probably a good soul and doesn't want to see anybody insulted. She's not looking at the comedy of it. She's looking at the fact that the words are, as you say, politically incorrect. Mm-hmm. But what we are doing is you have to know where the heart of the author is, and the heart of the author is telling the people that those words that are incorrect, turn them upside down, and that's what the truth is. Tell her that. For me, tell her I love her.
All right, I'll do that.
Thanks, Ed.
Thank you.
Let's hear now from Marianne. Marianne's calling from Brooklyn.
Hi, Carl. How you doing?
Put a little more Brooklyn into your voice.
Hey, I'm just for you, Carl.
Call is it. That's it.
I'm not from the Bronx, but I'm nearby.
My mother was from Brooklyn, so I know about Brooklyn.
Ah, you have the connection.
Yes.
Well, I just wanted to say, first of all, thank you for the years of laughter. And, you know, we miss you old-timers like Jimmy Durante and the crew.
Oh, yeah, we all miss him. And
great.
Luckily, we have records of them on film and radio. There are these the satellite radio now, I shouldn't plug satellite radio on NPR, but...
We're on satellite radio, too.
Yeah, every once in a while you'll hear one of these old shows. The other day I heard an old Burns and Allen radio show and Jimmy Durante. No, they will be with us forever. That's the lovely thing about these recording devices.
I love that old stuff. But anyway, I just wanted to know, do you have any advice for somebody who wants to get into the business who has no connections?
Oh, that's the best people to get into the business who have no connections. Then when they make it, they can really feel good. You know, the only thing you really need is to stick to it. And that may seem like a silly thing to say, but when somebody says, I'd like to be a, and they keep saying, I'd like to be a, and they don't do anything about it. If you want to be an actor, you find a little theater someplace. It doesn't matter if anybody sees you but four people. But if you're on a raised platform, a stage, whether it's a community stage, a church stage, whatever it is, you stick to it if you want to be an actor. If you're a writer, nobody can stop you. All you need is a pencil and paper. Sean O'Casey had a problem when he was 47 years old. When they asked what the biggest problem in writing, he says, I have no paper. I can't get paper. It was absolutely true. But if you can get paper and a pencil, you can be a writer. Nobody can stop you from doing that. It's the thing of sticking to it. And if you love it enough and you really – and another thing, if you have talent and you somebody knows you have talent and you know you have talent and you don't stick to it, that's a sin.
Right.
Carl Reiner will be remembered for many things, but among all of the other things, you'll be remembered as the husband of the woman who said, I'll have what she's having.
That's my wife, Estelle. My wife, Estelle, the jazz singer. Now, that's the most inspirational thing in my life. My wife, when I met when I was 21 years old, and I think all good things stemmed from the fact I married Estelle and had three great kids, Robbie Reiner, Annie Reiner, and Lucas Reiner, whose birthday it is today. My young 44-year-old son, who's an artist of renown now. He just came back from Milan, sold a lot of his paintings. Anyway, Estelle... was given that role by her son Rob in Harry and Sally, and it's on the air a lot now. We just watched it the other night, where she watches the orgasm scene, and she says to the waiter, "I'll have what she's having." When after Meg Ryan goes in paroxysms of excitement. And the funny thing about that is my son Rob keeps talking about that. He said, I couldn't believe it because I was showing Meg Ryan how I wanted her to do the part. And he says, I was impersonating somebody with having an orgasm. And while I'm doing it, I'm saying, oh, my God, my mother's watching me back there. And I don't know what she was. My wife was only worried about her line. She wasn't worried about that. And it's one of the 100 most famous lines ever. Something came out lately. Mm-hmm. It said the 100 greatest lines ever written.
In movie history,
By the way, yeah, and it was Billy Crystal came up with that line, and Rob told his mom, this is an extraneous line, but we love you to say it, and I don't know if it's going to be in the picture. And it's not only in the picture, but it's a forever.
Marianne, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you so much.
And good luck to you.
Thanks a lot.
Oh, by the way, Marianne, if you stay for a second, you asked about giving up. My wife, who started singing when she was 65 years old, is now recording her 7th album, a new album that we're actually doing now, Grown Up Songs for Children. And it's a brilliant album. She's a jazz singer, and she plays the ukulele. And 25 years ago, she got up after being in a movie that Annie Bancroft put her in. Anne Bancroft, she was directing, put her in a little movie called Fatso. And Estelle had never acted, never done anything. She was an artist. She painted, but she sang, and nobody knew she sang but me and a few people. And she, after being out in the world, she said, oh, this is fun. This is fun. You get out of the house, and you act, and you go, and people pay attention. So she said, what I really can do is sing. And she started going to little showcases and clubs. And in a year, she was singing them. And she sang in Michael's Pub in New York. And she sings here once a month. And she's really a great jazz performer. And she's been doing it now for, I won't say how many years, but she's up in years. And I think she wants to go in the Guinness Book of Records, being the oldest jazz singer singing in clubs yet. And she's, in October, she's singing in a club in which she sings every month, and it's called the Gardenia. And where am I?
Los Angeles. Last time I was
Los Angeles, right?
Thank you so much for being with us today, Carl Reiner. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're talking to me?
I thought
you were talking to that lovely lady from Brooklyn.
I'm trying to say goodbye gracefully.
Oh, yeah. That was as graceful as you can get.
It was very subtle, but, you know, I was trying to get the point across.
You know, thank you very much. And you know, I got a description. I asked one of your people a description of what you look like, because we don't see each other. You're in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
He described a man with a goatee, a very handsome man with a full head of hair, about 45 years old. Is that correct?
She's going in for salary review this afternoon. I can't imagine what that was all about. Carl,
I asked.
Carl, thank you so much.
Thank you, Neil.
Carl Reiner joined us from Beverly Hills in the Museum of Radio and Television there. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.